older and wiser with age-friendly Ireland, making the Isle of Wight a great place to grow older with the help of the Big Lottery Fund. Go to agefriendlyisland.org or give them a call on 01983 525 282.
Oh, that was a sudden halt, wasn't it? God, I was expecting a nice little fade out there, and it went bang, gone. Welcome back to the third hour of the show, our older and wiser slot. And today, I've got the very lovely Anna-Marie in here to talk to us about LGBT issues. And we're going to start, I think, with talking about some of the issues that older LGBT folk might be experiencing, which is kind of different, if you like, from others.
It is very, very different. Thank you for having me on
today.
No,
you're welcome. Welcome. We had a good time last time, didn't we?
We did. We had a really good time.
Yeah. Well, let's do it all again.
It's LGBT History Month this month. Yeah. We've got a lot going on the island, but it's really important to talk about actually some stats, I think. So you've got over 1.2 million older LGBT people within the UK alone, but they're actually a very invisible population.
When we're saying older, what sort of age groups are we talking about?
World Health Organization definition of old age is 50 plus.
Okay, that makes me feel much better, thank you.
I think I'm always not welcome when I say that.
No, you're always welcome.
Most people are actually shocked at what the World Health Organization
definition is. Yeah, I'm a bit shocked by that, actually, yeah. But okay, we'll live with it, yeah.
Yeah, but there's actually a lot of issues that older LGBT people will face compared to perhaps the general population. So some statistics research done proves you're more than 2.5 times more likely to live alone, more than twice as likely to be single, 4.5 times more likely to have no children. 20% of older LGBT people indicate they've got nobody to call on in times of crisis or difficulty, which is 10 times higher than the general population. And less than 25% will see biological family once a week, which, if you compare that to heterosexual people, is around 50%.
Oh, right, okay.
That's significant.
Is that because of the sort of rejection by families? Or?
Yep, there's a lot of rejection. There's many reasons for that. But, yeah, a lot of people do get rejected by their families still today. Certainly in the time that I've been doing this job, I'm aware of at least 5 children on the island who've been kicked out of their families and rejected for being gay or trans.
Yeah.
Which, you know, to me is very sad.
It is very sad. It's desperately sad.
And then they end up in the care system if they're children, or certainly as adults they go on and create their own lives and their own families of choice. Yeah. Which then, you know, makes it very hard to connect with your family.
Sure. Okay, that fact I found really interesting. There, we're looking at a little presentation that Anna's done here. Actually, you can't see it, but I can. And this one is that older LGBT folk are more likely to go back in the closet, and I found that quite fascinating, really, because it implies that they were out, but now have gone back in for a number of reasons.
Yes.
And that seemed a bit strange to me.
Yeah, having fought for so long to be out and proud. And I think old age is something that a lot of LGBT people fear. I know getting older isn't a topic that a lot of people are happy about, but actually there's some real legitimate concerns for LGBT people because actually the knowledge isn't there, the expertise isn't there to help people live their lives as themselves, open and out in care homes, or even when they're accessing care and other services. The services are not set up to actually be inclusive.
Right, so what we're saying is that people go into care and are treated as their kind of biological state rather than their chosen state, probably the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
Yep, so some people will be treated as if we've still got the very pink and blue boxes, because most people are brought up in a very pink and blue world, so male and female, and that's all there is. And
and
it's a very heteronormative society that we live in as well, so you are assumed heterosexual.
Yeah.
And anything outside of that is out of the norm.
And why wouldn't older folk want to if they've been out, want to sort of just come out and say, you know, this is what I am?
Because sometimes their historical experience of outing themselves to professional agencies or being outed to professional agencies or services have not gotten down well. If you think, you know, doctors historically would have sent people to have lots of horrific treatment, conversion therapy, aversion therapy, electric shock treatment, chemical castration, all kinds of stuff.
Which I guess younger folk won't be familiar with because that's long gone. But I can see now where if you were older and remembered that, then it would be a pretty scary thing to have to do.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And actually, conversion therapy is not illegal in this country, so you could Yes.
I didn't know that.
So you can still access conversion therapy, although it's not promoted.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of evidence to show how harmful it is, and there's criticism from the main organisations around it. It's not illegal in this country to have conversion therapy.
Oh, well.
So that's, you could still force a family member into trying to be converted not to be gay,
right,
which obviously isn't
that
successful in the scheme of things.
No, indeed, that's actually horrendous. I had no idea that was the case. I just kind of assumed, I guess there's many others really, that, you know, that's a thing in the past, that that's dead and buried a long time ago.
Yeah, I think the vast majority of people consider themselves to be inclusive and, you know, accepting of diversity, but actually, unless you know some of the specifics to each area, it's very, very hard to be inclusive.
So what we're saying really is then that all of us need to be sort of better educated, but maybe more aware of a lot of these issues. But that's got to be particularly true of sort of professional bodies like police, like hospitals, like care homes.
Yes, definitely. And I have been working over the last few years, and increasingly more so now, the message is getting through that actually that knowledge is missing, and it's vitally important for services and engaging with people to have that knowledge. So I've come fresh from the police station, having been delivering some training with the police today. We've got some really good events over the next month for LGBT History Month, again, to help increase awareness.
So can the general public sort of tap into some of these events to try and sort of broaden their knowledge of some of this?
So there's actually a display up in St Mary's in the Full Circle restaurant around LGBT history. Obviously, some of the training is more specific to that, but there are some events that people can go along to. So out on an island, have got Peter Tatchell coming to the island to talk about his history and talk about more from an oral history perspective, but again about LGBT rights and things, and that's a free event that the general public can come along to.
Brilliant. When's that going to be?
That's on the 19th of February, at Key Arts. It's on Eventbrite, I think.
So. Okay, cool, brilliant. And welcome back, Anna. Right, Anna, we've been talking in the break about all sorts of fascinating issues, which are a bit mind-boggling and a bit difficult to get your head around sometimes, but hopefully the work you do is going to help us to become a bit more enlightened about some of the issues that LGBT folk face. And one of those strings to your bow is this History Month 2020. I can't say LGBT. You have to think of a nice easy word, LGBT, for those of us who can't speak. History Month.
Yeah, so this year's theme is prose, poetry and plays. And it's obviously got a literature theme. There's a different theme each year. But it started back in 2005 as a way to help people connect with their history. I think we've come a long way in terms of getting some levels of equality. Full equality is still not there, but we've certainly come on a long, long way for people's rights. But along with that has come people blending more with society, and perhaps they're disappearing into their relationships, and that community being perhaps not what it was in terms of connection. So when people do need to connect, it's harder to do that. And certainly the younger people growing up who are coming out and finding societies, you know, a bit more tolerant perhaps, or accepting than it was, actually don't necessarily know the history or the importance of that. And actually Stonewall say by learning about our history we can better comprehend where we are as a community today, and that history is really, really important.
Yeah, and it's a pretty pretty poor history, I would guess, in terms of the way that society's reacted to LGBT in the past.
Yes, LGBT people have always existed since the beginning of time, but what's happened over time is that our history has either been silenced or edited or completely erased. So even within the Christian church, there were same-sex bishops, same-sex saints, and they've been written out.
Yeah.
And that knowledge of their existence has pretty much been eradicated in some parts.
Well, it's probably true that a lot of our history is dependent upon the ideas of whoever wrote them, really.
Totally.
Yeah, we've rewritten all sorts of parts of our history. And you don't know any different until somebody steps up and says, hang on, that's not quite the way it happened. This is the way it happened.
Totally.
And presumably that's what this initiative is trying to do.
Definitely. It's raising awareness not only within the LGBT community, but wider as well, so that people can learn and educate themselves a bit more, because it's really important for everyone to understand LGBT history. It's not just for LGBT people to be owning that. It's
well,
an important part
of society, really, shouldn't
we? We should
all own it, yeah. Do you think we are in a more tolerant place than we used to be? I mean, I know there, you know, same-sex marriage is with us now and all the rest of it, but you know, deep down, are we really more tolerant than we used to be?
I think technology's enabled us to be more informed.
Oh, that's different.
But I think, you know, without wanting to sound too political, overnight from the Brexit vote, we've seen massive increases throughout the country in all areas of hate crime.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem to show any sign of going away. In fact, in the last year, we've had an 81% increase in trans hate crime.
Yeah, see, 81 is not just a significant figure, it's a shocking figure, isn't it? I mean, it's just absolutely shocking.
And actually, you know, the stats literally overnight from the Brexit vote, with the increase in hate crime right across the spectrum of protected characteristics, absolutely horrendous, shocking statistics. And you know, you'd like to think that it would have calmed down by now, but actually I think a lot of the hate crime is still there, and it's still vastly underreported, so we still don't know the true picture of what is happening out there. We just know that people are reporting more incidences.
Sure So we need to promote tolerance, but you can only do that through knowledge, I guess, really, and that's really what this initiative
seems to
be about. So what sort of events are happening in order that people can try and sort of get to grips with some of these issues and just to learn a bit more about LGBT life, I guess?
Well, I'm always happy to come along and do some training and input for people, be it on a one-to-one basis, or I've got various training packages I will deliver for free for people to help understand. It's about cultural competency around LGBT issues.
I'd explain that, cultural competency.
It's about having the understanding, the knowledge, and being competent in engaging with LGBT people, getting terminology right, because that matters. Yeah. So,
and that is tricky, because I mean,
it changes all the time.
I do try, but I do find it hard, I must admit.
I think what happens as people get used to some terms that become embedded within society, but then actually sometimes newer terms or more accurate terms will come.
Yeah.
So when people are talking about trans people, gender diverse, sometimes they would say male to female or female to male.
Yeah.
But for someone who's trans, they would say, well, I was never male in the first place. So something that's come in a term, so you've got AMAB and AFAB, so assigned male at birth or assigned female at birth.
Oh, okay.
And so they're just more factually correct.
So
there's less harm done. Rather than saying, well, you're male to female or female to male, actually assigned male at birth or assigned female at birth is just more factually correct.
And language is important, I think, isn't it?
It is.
In these, similarly with kind of race issues, it's important to get these, they're not really definitions, I guess, but to get the language right, because if you understand the language, you get a better understanding of the issue, don't you?
Yeah, and you don't have to know all the different terms. There's new ones coming out all the time, they're changing. But what matters is you have the confidence and the knowledge in yourself to, if someone does trust you enough to come out to you or say, I'm pansexual or I'm bisexual, whatever, you say, okay, that's great. What does that mean for you? So you can understand what it means for someone personally, because sometimes terms will mean one thing to one person or something different to someone else.
Sure.
It's about having that knowledge and ability to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And actually, by being able to speak to someone and getting their pronouns correct, getting their names correct rather than perhaps dead naming someone, so using a name that they were previously, getting it right matters, because there's massive, massive suicide risks and self-harm risks if you misgender someone.
It's a brave thing to come out, really, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, I'll tell a little story. I won't name names, but back when I was probably late to 18, 19, maybe early 20s, I can't actually remember, but a dear friend of mine I used to see almost every day, you know. We used to, you know, just do stuff together. We used to go to pictures, used to go to see bands together. Really, really, probably best friend. And he drove, I didn't. So it was always his car, which was, you know, great for me. But pulled up outside my house one night, and he'd been a bit off all evening. He'd been a bit strange, a bit distant all evening. And I said to him, you know, what's the matter? And he came out to me that in the car outside my house that night and said, you know, he actually said, I think I'm bisexual. And I looked at him and said, well, you know you're bloody bisexual. You can't think you're bisexual, surely. Yeah. You know, you're either are or aren't. And he was, I mean, it was no issue. Really, but he was terrified.
He was terrified of losing you.
Yeah, he was terrified. I'd turn around and say, "Oh my, hands off!" You know, but you know, no threat. I've known him, you know, for years and years and years. You know, so there was no worry of that, really. But in his head,
totally, it's a very, very real situation for most people, that they will lose people when they come out.
Yeah.
And certainly for trans people, that's a significant thing. But actually, just one person accepting someone who's trans can reduce suicidal ideation by 75%. That's
really
massive. And that could be family of choice, just having someone that's accepting of them.
That's huge.
It is.
Huge, yeah.
It can make a massive difference.
That's a sobering thought, really. You know, we can all do that, can't we?
Totally.
You know, we can all show a bit of tolerance and a bit of understanding, and, you know, what difference does it make to a relationship, really, except to make it more open?
Exactly.
You know, it should be a positive thing, really.
There's nothing more beautiful than someone being their authentic self.
Yeah.
And I think we all know when someone's hiding something, and it does you know, create barriers, often unsaid, even if we don't know what it is.
Mm.
But actually, there's nothing more beautiful than someone being their authentic self and living their life to full. And, you know, that's what I'm hoping, that more and more people will get to be able to live their lives like.
Well, with your help, hopefully we can.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Right, I'm going to take another quick break. I'm going to play the first record I think I ever bought. We were talking about this a bit earlier, and you're going to admit what yours was, Anna. Go on.
Star Trekking.
There's Klingons on the Star Wars bell. Welcome back. Anna, we were talking about the difficulties of coming out to sort of an individual before the break, but it's obviously clearly, or probably, much more difficult to do that if you're coming out and trying to access some of the services that you might require, whether you're young or old.
Yes, definitely. And some people might say, you know, why do I need to know that someone's a lesbian, or why they're gay, if I'm going to support them? But actually, someone's story matters. And actually, to get a full picture of someone's life, you do need information like that in treating people with respect and honouring who they are, their history and whatever. If there was a lesbian who'd lost her partner, you know, in her 70s or 80s, actually, you know, talking about that partner may be really important to them, and,
sure,
and rather than having to hide it or pretend that they're a man, perhaps in the language that they use and in conversations with people, actually acknowledging that and having the conversations, it really doesn't matter. And if it was an older heterosexual woman, actually people wouldn't think twice about having a conversation about their husband, and it does matter.
Yeah, no, that's true. No, that's very true, actually. You can imagine a couple of old folks sitting somewhere together and, you know, chatting about their wives or their husbands, but if they're talking about same sex, then it suddenly becomes, or could suddenly become, a pretty huge issue.
So people then start editing out factors, you know, facts about their lives and people in their lives, or you know, perhaps referring to them in a different gender, just to try and make it more acceptable within their working lives.
How do we break out of this seemingly endless cycle then of blue and pink?
We really need to embed LGBT knowledge right from the word go. We need to be using much more inclusive language. So we do need to break open the pink and blue boxes, because you know, yes, pink and blue boxes will always exist, but there's also an amazing rainbow spectrum outside of those pink and blue boxes that exist as well. And again, that authenticity matters, and the more we get ourselves on that, you know, the better society will be, with people being able to be themselves fully and offer more to society way. But unless it's embedded everywhere, it's going to be very, very difficult. You know, Stonewall was created as a reaction to Section 28, which was imposed by Margaret Thatcher in, you know, late 70s, early 80s. And, you know, it's not that long ago that that was repealed. And actually, you've got teachers who are still teaching now who were teaching during Section 28. You've got most of the teachers that are, again, teaching now that probably went through schools during Section 28 and as students. And so, therefore, talking about LGBT matters even within schools can be challenging for people.
Sure.
So, you know, it's difficult in all areas, but, you know, that knowledge is lacking.
But obviously you're trying to spread the knowledge. You've been doing some work in prisons, you're telling me.
Yes, so I've been working in the prisons for a couple of years now, doing various things. There is a trans population within HMP Isle of Wight.
It's probably me being stereotypical, but I'm guessing that must be even more difficult for them in that situation.
To be a trans woman in a male prison must be absolutely terrifying. You know, it's not an easy process for them to go through, and access to care is, you know, and perhaps the services are even more stretched within that for them to reach. But we attend the LGBT forum in the prisons, and there is an LGBT history event coming up on the 20th within the prisons. So there's some good stuff happening. They also have Inside Pride each year on each site, Albany and Parkhurst. They have Inside Pride, where they will, each site has their very own different pride, but it's really, really fascinating to be a part of that and to help people celebrate who they are inside.
That's really interesting. That would have been the last thing I would have guessed, frankly. And I mean, I used to work in the probation service for many years, and so some experience in prisons, not currently, but some years ago. And it certainly wasn't back then the sort of environment you would expect any kind of real kind of tolerance or understanding at all.
And actually, HMP Isle of Wight, Parkhurst, back in, you know, around 99, when I was working in there, we had the first person to transition whilst in prison in the UK, who transitioned and was living in the prison then. Yeah. And, you know, groundbreaking stuff's been happening on the island. You just don't get to really hear about it that much.
No. But I think, are we still a bit, I don't know if ashamed is the right word, but are we still reluctant to broadcast these things, to publicise these things? Is it reluctance on the part of the prisoners to publicise these things, or any other organisation if it comes to that?
I don't know. There's been some positive coverage on TV recently with some trans, you can't call them prisoners anymore, so residents. I think Ross Kemp was doing a programme in Belmarsh, and they covered quite sensitively her story and how actually she was being released with no family and no support into the community because the hostels wouldn't take her because of her trans identity. There was just no provision, and that is an issue again.
It's fascinating stuff. I mean, I just pray that we can be a bit more tolerant in the future and try and break out of this pink and blue syndrome that we seem to be stuck in.
That would be amazing.
We're coming up to the end of the show, unfortunately. It's been lovely having you.
Thank you for having me.
You've kindly offered your services to any folk who want to learn more about these issues. So how can we get in touch with you?
So you can get in contact with me via Age UK Isle of Wight. This is Age UK Isle of Wight LGBT Facebook page, so you can message via that. I'll phone on 525282.
Brilliant, that's lovely. Thanks for coming in, Anna.
Thank you.
Pleasure, as always. I'm going to finish with a song by The Young'uns, which is relevant to this discussion that we've been having this afternoon. It's actually a true story of a gay man who commits suicide, unfortunately, because of rejection by his family. It's a fabulous song. It's a very sad song, but it's also quite an inspiring song, I think. So to finish the show, let's have the Young'uns and Be the Man, and we'll see you next week.
Matthew Hoxton is my name, and you'll not hear me mourn. I will never live in shame. I will not walk alone. For though my love took his own life because of bigotry, I'll be the man, be the man, be the man I was born to be. I was born to be. And my love, he was warm and kind, and my love, he was strong. And when his brown eyes first met mine, I knew he was the one. And though I walk a silent road, he will walk with me if I be.
That's where